Luke chapter 14, verse 25, that's where we'll pick up today. Last week we studied Jesus at a dinner party where just about everyone around him received some corrective and adjusting words from him. First, there was the religious leaders that were looking down their long, pious noses at Jesus, watching and waiting for some sort of weakness that they could exploit in him. And then you had the guests at this dinner party that Jesus addressed. And what was their problem? Remember, they were all fighting over the good seats. Now, as I told you last week, the good seat was any seat that was closest to the host up front. Those were the best seats, just like here at Anchored. And it's amazing that we do not have that problem here at Anchored. People fighting over the front seats. That's why I took and I put these metal uncomfortable chairs in the front row. I knew they would not get used. Now, we do have a few people up close to the front. I'm just saying. But the rest of you, thank you for your humbleness, your humility. And we don't have to worry about that in here. So Jesus had something to say to those that were vying for the best parking spots. I mean, pardon me, Rob. The best seats in the house. He had something corrective to say to them. Thirdly, there was the host that Jesus scolded for having the wrong motives for throwing the party in the first place. He did it all just to have people honor him and revere him and be impressed by him. Fourthly, there was the guy who interrupted Jesus, and Jesus had something, I guess you could say, corrective for him. Certainly, Jesus had to adjust his theological thinking, his viewpoint on salvation. Hey, it wasn't as open as that guy thought. He thought because his bloodline was Jewish that he was as good as saved. Jesus let him know it's not about that. It's about an invitation from the Lord to come and commune with him. And it's about accepting that invitation and showing up and letting nothing distract you. And last of all, today we come to, we'll say, the fifth group that Jesus addresses at this dinner party. Beginning at verse 25 and through verse 35, we're going to take a look at the crowd, because Jesus is going to have something to say to these multitudes that have followed him. And you're wondering, where did these multitudes come from? Were they invited to this party? Well, let me just tell you this. They were at this party. No, they were not invited. But these multitudes that followed Jesus were at this party, kind of. And you say, Arlen, what do you mean kind of? I'm glad you asked, because this is something you really need to know. The way that big, expensive, extravagant parties back then, the way that these dinner parties were held is these wealthy people would host in their homes these parties, but their homes back then were too small to be able to house all of those people, sit them down and have dinner. So they would have these extravagant dinner parties in what they called their courtyards. Now, today we would just call that a fenced-in or hedged-in backyard. So that's what they would do. They would have these dinner parties in their backyard because they couldn't get everyone in their house. Maybe you have that same problem when you have your annual family reunion parties. You can't get them all in your house, just not enough room. So, sorry, Grandma, here's a lawn chair. We're going outside, right? Barbecue on the grill. We're eating outside. We're sitting in the sun. Same thing back then. Now, historically, we know that these wealthy homes, they would leave one end of their courtyard open, visible to the public. You might wonder, why would they do that? You know, our politicians today, our wealthy people today, they've got the giant walls around their entire yard. They want the privacy. Well, they did it back then because, as we saw from last week, these wealthy people, these prominent people, they wanted to be seen by the community. So they knew that when they had these extravagant parties, that if they left one side of their courtyards open, that the community would be walking by and look in and see how important all these people were. and see how special and fancy, and hear some of the fine conversation about philosophy and theology and just be wowed and impressed. So they were okay with that. That's what they wanted. And that's exactly what this crowd here that Jesus is going to address beginning at verse 25 is all about. This is a crowd of people that has followed Jesus to this party. They crashed the party. They weren't invited, but they're there because of Jesus. They're listening to Jesus. They're watching Jesus. They're impressed by Jesus. They believe in Jesus in some form or another. And probably they're just waiting for him to be done with this dinner party so that they can have that communication and connection back with Jesus. But that's where we are as we begin the chapter. So let's begin reading, not the chapter, but the verse. So let's begin reading at verse 25. Now great multitudes went with him. And now real quick, just to let you know, this could mean that these great multitudes went to this dinner party with Jesus. Or it could mean that these great multitudes went with Jesus as he left this dinner party. We're not quite sure which one it is, but here's what we do know. Either way, this multitude has crashed this party. So they've heard all the conversation. This is a crowd of followers. This is a crowd of believers on some level. You know, they had to be at least somewhat entertained and excited as they listened to Jesus person by person, group by group, reveal the problems and correct people and take on the big dogs, organized religion, the religious leaders, the scribes and Pharisees. You know, we admit there's something sick in our nature that we love to see the arrogant brought low. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying it's a thing. And they were there hearing all that. And they're the followers of Christ. They're the in crowd. So they're probably not expecting something challenging or correcting from Jesus. And yet essentially, that's what he gives. He's going to have something to say to the crowd too. Not just the religious people that don't believe in him, but his crowd of followers as well. So let this register. These were followers of Jesus, and yet Jesus had something challenging, even corrective, we might say, to say to them. Let that register. So he's going to speak to current followers about what it costs to be a disciple. Let's read on. And he turned and said to them, verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Well, we better deal with the giant elephant in the room real quick here. Because it sure sounded to me like Jesus just said, if you don't hate father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, and self, then you cannot be his disciple. Now, if you believe that Jesus just commanded his followers to hate, then you know about as much of the Bible as Joe Biden knows the Declaration of Independence. I mean, you know the thing. Now, it is sad that some people read this and believe that Jesus is commanding us to hate, but as a believer, as someone who has even casually leafed through the scriptures, you should be able to read this statement from Jesus and a little flag should stick up in your head that says, hold on, I need more information here. Something isn't sitting right. Because if we look at the bulk of what Jesus said, this is quite out of character. There's got to be something here we don't understand, right? Let me share with you what Jesus taught everywhere else in the scriptures. I mean dogmatically, thoroughly, conclusively. Let me read to you some of the things that Jesus taught in the scriptures. Matthew 19:19. When he was quoting the Ten Commandments, he said this, not hate your father and mother, but honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. All right, so that stopped the first one right away. I don't want any of you kids going home telling your parents you hate them, and then when they ask why, you say, the Bible tells me so. No. No, all right? We know Jesus said, standing upon the Ten Commandments, honor your father and mother, love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew 5, verse 43, verse 44, Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Sounds pretty good there. But Jesus said this, I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Now, honestly, you think Jesus wants you to hate parents and family when he just told you don't even hate your enemies? I think we're catching on to something here. John 13, verses 34 and 35. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. What do you know? You even have to love the church people. Man, he's got us from every angle. So what does he mean? In Luke 14, 26, when he says, if you don't hate mother, father, sister, brother, even self, don't forget that one, that you can't be my disciple. Well, here's the problem. Jesus didn't get to Luke 14 and then forget what he believes and then contradicts himself. Here's the issue. The issue is translating a Middle Eastern language that is very sharp. Here is a difficulty translating the way that a group of people talk when they talk in a rather sharp and contrasting way. The word that is used here for hate in the Greek, it is the word meseo, and it has two meanings. A primary meaning is hate or detest. A secondary meaning is this, to love less. All right, now, if we're just taking a Greek concordance and we look up this word, meseo, and we see that that Greek word can mean hate, but it can also mean to love less. Which one do you think Jesus intends here? In fact, it's exactly the way that Matthew worded it in Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. Quoting Jesus, he said, simply this, you can't love father or mother, sister or brother, anyone else, not even yourself, more than you love me if you want to be a disciple. That was his statement. The wording in Luke is sharp because he's painting a contrast. He's giving you a sharp contrast. In other words, he's saying it something like this. Now, it's even still too strong in our way of communication, but this is the way he said it. And that's why the literal translation is upheld. He said it essentially like this. If your love for all others is not hate in comparison to your love for me, you cannot be a disciple. Okay, that's elephant in the room number one. Here's elephant in the room number two. We need to understand exactly where he's going with this, and we need to define a word. And to define that word, I'm going to define two things. Salvation and discipleship. Salvation and discipleship. This is going to help us with the rest of this definition. Are salvation and discipleship the same thing? That is a tricky question. In one sense, yes. In another sense, no. If we're speaking about initial conversion, initial salvation. Here's the fact. If we're going to define salvation and discipleship, we're going to define them differently, and we're going to find them to be two different phases, two different things in the Christian life. Absolutely, I concede they are inextricably connected, but they are different by definition. How would you define salvation this morning? You would say, correct me if I'm wrong, and if you do correct me for being wrong, you're wrong because your definition's wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong. How would you define salvation? You would say it is coming to Christ for forgiveness of sins It is repenting of sin, and it is having faith that he is your Savior. All right, we all on board with that definition. How would you define discipleship? Would you define it that same way? No. How would you define discipleship? You would look up the word, either in English or in the Greek, and here's what you'd come up with. Mathetes in the Greek. Here's the definition of the word. A pupil, a student, a learner, we would say an apprentice, an apprentice. So this is someone that is studying under a master to train and develop to the point that they can continue on in that same work of the master. Like a carpenter who's an apprentice. He's training to be a carpenter. And when he's good enough, he can have his own business because he can do the work. That's what a disciple is. It is a student of the scriptures. Now, please don't just think that means showing up and hearing a Bible study. That does not make you a student of the scripture. A student of the scripture is someone that is genuinely learning from the scriptures so that they can do. A professor years ago was approached by sort of a nemesis because one of his students had done something that he thought should bring shame to that professor. So he went up to that professor and he said, "Did you hear what one of your students did?" And the professor wisely quipped back and said, "That man may have attended my lectures, but he is not my student." So make sure you understand the same holds true in Christianity. Being a student of the word, being a disciple is not simply hearing the scriptures, but it is learning. This is hands-on stuff. This is on-the-job training. This is learning from the Lord that we might walk in his steps and continue on in his work. So it's a process, right? Discipleship is a process. It's for the saved, but it's not salvation in and of itself. It's a part of salvation. It's a flow of salvation. It is the natural progression that the Lord wants every single soul, every single believer to go through. What is that natural progression? It's real easy. We probably all come up with different words. But here's that progression. Salvation. Discipleship. And what's the third one? Apostleship. Salvation, discipleship, and apostleship. What is apostleship? That's essentially your graduation from training. That's when you've passed all the courses, you've learned the stuff that you need to learn, and you begin to go out and actually do the work. The word apostle means an ambassador, one who is sent on behalf of Christ. So that's the process, right? Salvation, discipleship, and then apostleship, where you're actually representing Christ in his stead and doing his work. What did Jesus start with? 12 guys that followed him. He made them disciples. He discipled them. And when it was all said and done, they became apostles that were out there doing the work. So here's what Jesus is not saying in Luke 14:26. He's not saying, if there is anyone on the earth that you love even a little bit more than me, I'm not going to let you be saved. Yet that's probably how you've read it. And before we define those words, that's probably how you read that verse. You probably read that and said, whoa, I thought salvation was by faith. I didn't know that when I came to Christ to be saved, my love for him had to already be completely and fully developed, that love had to already be the prominent love in my life so that I would qualify for salvation. That's probably how you read that scripture, and it probably confused you. But now we've defined the words, and we need to make the distinction. Last week, in Luke chapter 14, Jesus was speaking to people that did not believe in him. And what was he trying to do? What stage of that process, salvation, discipleship, apostleship, what stage of that process was he trying to get them to? Salvation. And so at a dinner, he uses that analogy to get people to come to the table, so to speak, and have communion with him. Salvation. But for this group, beginning at verse 25, that are followers of Jesus, that is, they have some capacity of faith in him, whether it's pure or impure, whether it's right or wrong, whether the motives are good or bad. Fact is, they have some belief in him. And what is Jesus trying to do with this group of followers, these believers? Is he trying to get them saved? Is that what Luke 14 is? If I'm not the greatest love, you're not saved. He's not trying to get them saved. That's not what verse 26 is about. He's trying to turn them into disciples so that one day he can turn them into workers. That's what he's doing. So there's a difference. Do you all see it? Do you all agree? You know what? Better not say. Because I'll just keep going on. So here's the message of Luke 14, 26. For those who want to train to do ministry and then eventually do ministry, you cannot have a greater love than Christ if you actually want to continue that progression of discipleship into apostleship. It is impossible. Because life is going to constantly make you choose between your loves. Have you noticed that as a Christian? Life is going to constantly stick you at a crossroads and make you choose between God and this or something else or some other person. There's going to be constant crossroads where you have to choose. And it's not that, please hear this, it's not that this message here is that if your love in the discipleship process, if your love isn't good enough, if your love isn't developed enough that you get kicked out of the discipleship program, that's not the message here. All he is doing is sharing a truth with us. Not that he kicks us out of the discipleship process if our love is weak. It's simply this. If your love for him isn't tops, then you're not fit for ministry. You're not fit for ministry because you're going to hit these crossroads where you have difficult decisions to make, and you, not the Lord, you are going to opt out and choose some other love. That's all he's telling you here. If we're honest, we know that baby Christians, when they come to Christ, their love for Christ is not perfect. Their love for Christ is not fully developed. They probably love Christ very little because they don't know Christ. That love for Christ develops throughout their salvation as they disciple. But it's just like a baby. When you have that newborn baby in real life and it comes out and it's this big, does it really love you? Here's all I think it knows. More milk. Take care of this diaper issue. That's all that baby knows. That baby's not born with perfect love for mama or dad. As that baby goes through life in that relationship, love develops. Same for the baby Christian. No, you do not have to have perfect love to be saved. Salvation's not by love anyway. Salvation is by faith. The whole point of salvation is you come to Christ completely unworthy. Right? Isn't that what it's about? You come to Christ completely unworthy. Your works have been sinful. Your love for him non-existent. You come completely unworthy and he accepts you and saves you. But for the disciple, he wants you to know, hey, if you're going to be in this thing for the long run, if you're going to be working, if you're going to be training to be in ministry in any capacity, visible or personal, here's a fact. If there are things you love more than Christ, the enemy's going to make sure to stick you in those situations where you make those hard choices, and chances are you're going to choose your love for your spouse or your kid or your family or friends. These constant crossroads. God or gal. Master or marriage. Faith or family. Or how about this one for self? Learning or lounging. Do you love yourself more than you love the Lord? If so, you're probably going to spend a lot of time watching Netflix and not studying the scriptures. That's the message. Could you do what Abraham did in the Old Testament when he was willing to sacrifice his son Isaac because God told him to? Could you do that? Now, believe me, just to clear this up, the Lord doesn't ask that of anyone anymore. So don't put the knife to your kid's throat and say the Lord told you. No, no one is buying that. You brought that kid into this world. You put up with that kid. But could you do that? I'm going to say probably not. And what does that tell you about your love? Even you developed Christians, what does that tell you about your love? Maybe you love your kids a little more than the king. I don't know. This isn't about perfect love. This is about the Lord warning you. If you want to stick in ministry, there may be some tough decisions where you upset the wife or the husband or the kids. There may be some tough crossroads where you have to pick the right road and someone's going to get hurt and it's going to feel like hate to them. You know who John Bunyan is? Not Paul Bunyan. John Bunyan, you know who he is? He was a preacher in England in the 1600s, a little bit before my day. And at that time in England, there was a crackdown on the church. There was a persecution, and they approached John Bunyan and they said to him, you have two choices. You stop preaching about Christ and you keep your freedom and your family. Or you continue on preaching about Christ and you are going to prison. Now, that was a tough decision. That was a tough crossroad for John Bunyan. Would have been for Paul Bunyan, too. That's a tough crossroad to be at, because John Bunyan knew that if he went to prison for preaching Christ, he had no way to provide for his family financially. He knew that was going to mean poverty for his family. So the decision he made was to continue preaching Christ, because he understood this truth. Discipleship, apostleship, ministry is about that one ultimate love that has to be at the top. And he made that decision, and he spent 12 years in prison for making that decision. And during those 12 years, he wrote the book called Pilgrim's Progress. Have you ever read it? If you have not read that book, please buy it. Get an ebook copy. You can get it for free on Kindle. Get that and read that. I believe that is a book that every Christian should have in their library and actually have read. And in that book, he's got a section about Christian, the main character of that story, deciding to follow the Lord. Deciding to leave the city of despair and follow the Lord. And his wife and kids laughed and mocked at him. They refused to go. They stayed in that city of despair. And Christian decided, I can't stay. They're not my greatest love. And Christian, in that story, Pilgrim's Progress, he followed the Lord. He left his family and followed the Lord. That came from experience, from John Bunyan. He did that. Now, that is an extreme case. I mean, an extreme case. Likely none of you will ever be asked to do by the Lord. Let me give you a more modern case. I have seen this with my own eyes. That was back when I didn't need glasses either. So, I mean, I know what I saw. I saw this with my own eyes. A minister who had ministered, and I can't go into too much detail or else people in this city will know exactly who I'm talking about. But saw with my own eyes a minister who was in active pastoral ministry for many years, felt a God call to be a senior pastor, and I saw him reach that crossroads where he had to make the decision, wife or ministry, woman or God. And let me just say, he's been on the shelf. Ministry speaking, he's been on the shelf for many years, doing essentially nothing because he made his choice. He picked his greatest love. Now, you know how the order goes, church. We say it all the time. This is all that Jesus is revealing to us in the matter of discipleship. You know how the order goes. In the words of Joe Biden, you know the thing. God first. Pastor second. No, I'm sorry. God first. Family second. Fellowship third. That's the order. We know that to be the order. We know that that is God's will for the disciple. And we know that there are going to be challenges to that. And we understand that what Jesus is saying here is essentially the same thing. Our love for him must be the greatest love if we want to be disciples. Now, I'm not questioning that guy, that story I told you. I'm not questioning his salvation. I'm not. All I'm doing is saying that is a real life example of what Jesus is teaching us here. It was modeled right before my eyes. The words of Jesus are true. If he is not your greatest love, something will pull you out of ministry in the future. So, now tie this in with what we know from last week. What was that summary statement that we made about our message from last week, the words of Jesus? Our message was this, and I really like this one. Our message was this: grace does not like open seats. You remember that? Grace wants a full house. All right, if you just want to bring it up full circle, we'll just say like this: the Lord doesn't want empty seats. The Lord wants a full house in the matter of salvation. Let's draw the dividing line. When it comes to salvation, the Lord doesn't want an empty seat. The Lord wants a full house. But listen, here's what we're learning this week. In the matter of discipleship, the Lord is more concerned about quality over quantity. Salvation, hey, anyone who wants to come to the table can come to the table. And Jesus said this: anyone that comes to me, I will by no means cast out. Anyone that wants to come to the table and be saved and have that communion with him, you're welcome. But if you want to be a disciple, there's got to be quality there. And that's what the rest of this message is about. Verse 27, and whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Again, we covered this in our Luke studies not all that long ago, really. You should know the real meaning behind this. It comes from just understanding the way Roman crosses and crucifixions worked. We'll take the face value of that. You know, the full meaning, we'll take the face meaning of that. And we'll just say it means this. It means marching to the death of self, right? You've got your cross. There's more to it. We understand bearing a cross, carrying a cross meant your guilt and your shame was on display. So part of the meaning there is that in discipleship, in training for ministry, you never get too far away from this, making it very well known that you are unworthy of Christ, that you are guilty, that you are a sinner. But the ultimate culmination of bearing that cross was what? Getting it up on the hillside, sticking it on the ground, and you hanging on that. That means death to self. So there's an emphasis here that this is not just about Christ being your greatest love, but this is about daily dying to self. That is what ministry is. And without that, ministry just doesn't go. I mean, if you love yourself too much and you just love to have yourself entertained, that's all you're going to do. If you love yourself so much that you just want to keep buying yourself possessions to reward yourself for your greatness, that's all you're going to do. You're going to spend all your time on the boat and on the four-wheeler and whatever you do. Well, I guess maybe not you ladies, but you men. So to be a disciple, to be training, to be a worker, to do kingdom stuff, man, you have to be a selfless person. You have to die daily. Verse 20, hang on. Verse 28, for which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Verse 29, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him. Verse 30, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Ha ha. Now, you have to count the cost before you begin the project. Fair statement. Keep in mind, we are still not on the topic of salvation. We are on the topic of discipleship. When you get saved, you don't have to count up the cost and try to figure out, now let's see, am I really a good enough person that I think I can stay saved? That's not what the Lord is teaching here. Again, this is about discipleship. This is about being his student, his pupil, learning at his feet and then actually doing what you're learning. And what he's saying is that in the matter of salvation, you believe, you repent, you're saved, that's it. The Lord keeps you saved. Your true salvation is going to bear itself out throughout your life. But in the matter of discipleship, you need to sit down and take a good hard look at yourself. And you need to do the math. You need to do the math. Now, in building projects, this is me to a T. This is exactly what I do. I sit down, whatever I'm going to build, I sit down and I get my paper out and I draw up a detailed, I mean detailed blueprint of what I'm going to build. Now, it's unreadable chicken scratch to everyone else, but to me it is a detailed blueprint of what I'm going to build. I write down every measurement of every board, every length of every board. I count how many boards I need. I figure out what material I'm going to buy. I get the prices online. So by the time I go and walk into Lowe's with my mask on, after I've waited in line 6 feet apart from someone else, I know exactly what things to get, and I know exactly how much it's going to cost. That's the way that I do construction projects. That's what the Lord is teaching us about discipleship. That's how we need to approach discipleship. We need to sit down and figure out if we have what is needed to finish the job, if we're really in both feet, if we're completely in. Because we don't want to get to the, you know, like with my building projects, I don't want to get to the checkout and then find out, oh, I don't got enough on my card because I bought more expensive boards and I didn't really do the calculating and I didn't think it would be this much, but I didn't really run the numbers. I didn't really sit down and figure it out. And now my card won't go through. Call Maggie. Maggie, where's your card? You don't want that happening in the process of your discipleship. You need to be considering, can I really do this? Can I be a true student of the Master? Do I have what it takes? Is there any area in my life that's going to arise in the future that's going to cause me to come up short? Is there any love in my life that's going to arise up and cause me to choose that over the Lord? That includes yourself, once again. Now, I don't know why, but every time I read this verse, I always think of the ark up on the mountaintop there, Route 68 in Frostburg, Maryland. It's really sad. Forgive me for a minute, but I always think of that because, you know, when they started building that ark, God's Ark of Safety Church, 1976. That's the year I was born. Now, don't do that math. Do the other math, the discipleship math. Don't do that math. They started that in 1976, the year I was born. And to my knowledge, in the last 3 decades, they haven't added a single screw or bolt to that thing. They quickly put the frame up, the steel frame of it up, and that's all they've done for 30 years. Now, there's a lot I can say about that, but let me just put it to you like this. It's almost as if someone didn't sit down and count up the cost. Can I finish this? If I start this, do I have what it takes to finish this? Don't do that with your discipleship. When it comes to your discipleship, do the math. Sit down and figure this out. Can I give what the Lord is calling for? Because look at the difference between salvation and discipleship. Here's the difference between salvation and discipleship. Salvation is a free gift. But here's the catch 22 for you new Christians. Discipleship costs you everything. It costs you everything. Now, I can tell you a lot of stories, but I probably shouldn't, or else you'll never consider discipleship. So forget I brought that up. It can cost you everything. The crazy thing is that there is nothing more rewarding and fulfilling than discipleship and ministry. Nothing. When Jesus sent the disciples there in around Sychar there in Samaria to get food, and he had that conversation with the woman at the well, and she ended up believing in him as Messiah. They came back from Sychar with the food, you know, Sychar burgers or whatever they had. They came back with the food, and Jesus wasn't hungry, and the disciples were perplexed. They're scratching their heads and they're asking, did someone give him something to eat? What happened? He was hungry. That's why we went to get food. He's no longer hungry. Remember what Jesus said? Jesus said this, my food is to do the Father's will. And we see that on several occasions in the life of Jesus, depleted from ministry, exhausted, stressed, worn down, hungry, tired. And then he would do some ministry and life would come back to him and he would say, my food is to do the Father's will. That's where I get my nourishment, my sustenance, my substance from. Ministry, discipleship. And it's the same way. Now, verse 31 is in the same vein, quickly. Or what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000, verse 32, or else while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So again, pertaining to discipleship, you don't just rush off to war without figuring out if you can win. It's a great analogy too, because ministry feels like war sometimes. Ministry feels like battle. And I like how he doesn't say, you got to sit down and figure out if your 20,000 can beat their 20,000. He says, you got to sit down and figure out if your 10,000 can beat their 20,000. I think that's his way of letting us know that in ministry, in discipleship, you're always going to feel outnumbered, outmanned, outgunned, outmaneuvered. That's always going to be the feeling. Now, the biblical truth is what? You and God against no matter who many else, that wasn't really good English, but you and God against even the rest of the world are a majority. But here's what ministry is going to feel like. In the flesh, you are just outdone. And you got to sit down and you got to figure out, am I going to be able to stick with this? Now, he's given us two analogies, the tower analogy and the war analogy. And that is so perfect, because that's ministry, that's discipleship. It is both building and battling. And that's the Christian life in general too. It's building and it's battling. Verse 33, so likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Remember what I said? Salvation is a free gift. It costs you nothing. It's a free gift that you don't have to be worthy of. But what is discipleship? It costs you everything. There can't be anything that you're not willing to part with if you want to be involved in ministry. And take it from me, a guy
who's been doing just that for a long time, ministry. And, you know, it wasn't always easy, but the Lord has helped me to let go of a lot of loves in life, a lot of things that I just thought I couldn't do without. And if you're going to be in the discipleship process, He's going to do the same thing for you. He's not going to pull you out of the program. He's going to help you through the program. Well, 34 and 35, we'll close with this. Worship team can come up. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? Verse 35, it is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And you're probably thinking that just completely sounds out of place with what we're talking about in discipleship here. But is it really, though? Is it really out of place? Actually, not at all. Because Jesus was talking about counting up the cost before entering discipleship and eventual ministry. So it was all about knowing what you're getting yourself into. And he closes this chapter with this, an exhortation about endurance. He says this, don't lose your saltiness. And finally you're thinking, now I got this one. I'm good at this. I have a very salty personality. This is me. No problem with this one. You know, it's like that meme that's been floating around that says, Jesus didn't say be salty and lit. He said be salt and light. You do have to kind of explain this to the new generation because they mangle our words. Matthew 5 is the full explanation of this. We're the salt of the world. We're the light of the world. Jesus is saying in closing, if you do begin the ministry process, don't lose your edge. Don't lose the saltiness. What does salt do? It makes thirsty. It adds flavor. It preserves from corruption. All the things that salt does. And that's what Jesus said the church is. As the church, as disciples, as followers, you add a flavor to the world that the world really needs. You make the world thirsty when they see your life. They might not even know what you have, but they just know you got something they don't have. They got more than you as far as stuff goes, but you got more than them as far as the heart goes. They got more stuff and they're miserable and they're suicidal. You got practically maybe nothing, but you do have joy and peace in your heart, and that makes the world thirsty. And the other thing that salt, the church, does is it preserves this world from corruption. And again, if the church was lifted off the planet right now, there would be nothing to stop a horrible agenda that is on this world scene right now. Don't lose that edge in your discipleship, in your progress to become a sent one, an apostle. Don't lose that edge along the way. Now, would you stand with me?